allow Palestinians to come here, to open our borders to them, we have no way of assuring them that if, when they want to go back, that they will be allowed to return. Palestinians and Native Americans are the only groups of people in the entire world where their return to their land and their property is not governed by them, and that has to change.
I want to bring Narman Abu-Shaban into this conversation, Sophia, another of your clients. Narman, thanks so much for being with us. You're a Palestinian American attempting to expedite your request to rescue your siblings and their families from Gaza. We're speaking to you in Detroit. First, our deep condolences on the loss of your mother. Can you talk about what happened to her and what your situation is?
Hi, good morning. I just want to thank you for having me here to share my story about my mother, even though there are like no words that can describe what happened. My mother is an old lady who was living safely in her home. She was displaced many times. Every time they get displaced, they move to another house. They are threatened to bomb that. The Israeli forces are threatening them to bomb the house. So my brothers had to displace her. She's paralyzed. She's on medications, and due to the air forces threatening them to displace many times, they were in the north. They had to go to the south. Even when they were in the south in Khan Yunis, they were threatened in the middle of the night to leave their house. They had to displace her again until they reached to Rafah. In there, her health was getting worse and worse until she didn't have the medication, the right medication. Due to the Israeli forces, they prevented the medical supplies to get into Gaza. So she had to switch to another medication that did not help her at all. And she passed away, Allah yarhamha.
And Norman, how has it been possible for you even to communicate with family members in Gaza to assess their situation and their state?
It's really hard for me to communicate with them. I had to have my phone international calls to be able to call them. Nowadays, it's not working. It was working before, but now it's not working at all. They have to go to the hospital to get some internet connection so they can talk to me. They send me like in specific times of the day, like in the middle of the night. I have to keep my eyes open so I can see when they can text me or when they can send me a WhatsApp like message to see if they're okay or not. But my siblings that are in the north, I have no communication at all. My brother, I haven't been hearing from him for 2 weeks now, and he's in the healthcare, and the Israeli forces are targeting all the healthcare professions. And all I know that they surrounded the houses there, and they're shooting on people. But I don't know anything about my brother and his family that are like more than 10 kids and grandkids.
Norman, have you been speaking with your senator, with Dick Durbin, and what has been the response?
I have been actually I did send emails, but I didn't get any reply. I filed the crisis intake. I put all my siblings, my mother, and I've been emailing them, telling them about her situation and my sibling's situation. But I didn't get any answer. They've been saying that they're not in the category. They don't fall in the category to get them, only immediate family, and they are immediate family. They like, what do they consider immediate family? After my mother's death, like 2 days after, I got an email that they put my mother's name on the list to be evacuated. So I had to send them again that she's dead, it's too late. They told me that they're gonna put my siblings' names on the Rafah crossing. They even send me the names that they will put them, and they send them the Rafah crossing. But still, it's been like 3 weeks, and I haven't heard anything. And I don't want to lose my siblings, as I lost my uncle, as you know. Like, my uncle and his entire family were bombed by the Israeli forces, by the airstrike. And my uncle's an old man. He was in his home playing with his grandchildren. His wife was feeding her grandchild. They bombed the house on top of them. They were under the rubble for 1 week. They could not get there. Nobody could get in there to help them until the air forces, the Israeli soldiers left. They wouldn't allow anybody to get in there. So I don't want to lose my brothers and my sisters. Every day I hear like bombing and striking people and targeting hospitals, civilians. I want to reunite with my siblings. I don't want to lose them the way I lost my mother. I just want them to evacuate. If they don't stop the genocide, they don't stop it at all, so they can sleep. There are children, there are women, there are like all of them. They're always scared. They can't sleep. So if they don't stop the genocide, this is the only thing I can do. I can like ask for your help, for the Department of State to help me evacuate my siblings.
We are speaking to Narman Abu-Shaban, Palestinian-American, talking to us from Detroit. She's already lost her mother, her uncle, attempting to have her request expedited to rescue her siblings and their families from Gaza. And we are rejoined by Fadi Abu-Shamala from Cairo. Fadi, we understand that your three kids and wife, just got through Rafah into Egypt just before this broadcast, as you were attempting to get them out. Can you talk about their situation and how you're trying to get into the United States at this point? You are Just Visions Outreach Associate in Gaza and the executive director of Gaza's General Union of Cultural Centers.
Yeah, I would start answering this question by saying that the trip and the journey that my kids have to go through it, it start from October 9 when we decided to evacuate our homes from Gaza City into my parents' home in Khan Yunis, and working in journalism and speaking up about for the Palestinian people and all the massacres and genocide that it's going on in the ground by the Israeli occupation. We reach a point that I have to evacuate. I have to leave Gaza Strip because there was like really risk over my family, because Israel, until that day, I'm talking about November 14. Until that date, around 61 journalists have been killed. My family feel that they are in danger and they might be bombed any time. That's made me have to sleep in my car for one time the night before I leave Gaza Strip, and I thought that's by traveling to Cairo, I will be able to help my family to evacuate. I mean, my name only was on the list of November 2. I mean, the U.S. list of November 2. So, but it didn't happen. That's what I want to say. Then on December 5, the Israeli occupation did throw leaflets asking the people of Khan Yunis to evacuate to Shabura refugee camps, which is in Rafah City. And the next day, and before the next day, they have to evacuate. Like after 7 hours, I figured out that they arrived safe to Rafah City. It wasn't easy for me like to be waiting, because I knew in the news that they were bumping in the streets, and in the same street that they are using to evacuate Rafah City. The next day on December 6th, while I don't have connection with my wife and my kids, I get I knew that from the news that the Israeli occupation bombed in a Shabura refugee camp, exactly where is my family are evacuating. And to get more like orientation about this refugee, it's just only 15 kilometers square. It's a very small neighborhood, and it consists of also old buildings, and there's a very high risk that all these buildings will be demolished because of this bombing. For 2 hours and a half, I was waiting any sign that my family are alive. I had to go through the what's the news of WhatsApp thread to look for my kids' photo. I had to look into the photos of the killed children, because I knew that there's 20 women and kids were killed in this bombing. I had to open the photos and zoom in to determine if one of these photos is one of my kids. It wasn't easy for me at all, like, to have this 2 hours and a half waiting any sign that my family alive. It wasn't the end, but even so, the next night and the next night and the next night, they have daily bombing in Shabura and in Rafah City. This is the place that exactly Israeli commission said that it's a safe area, as exactly they say that the Palestinian people from Gaza City have to evacuate to Khan Yunis. They consider Khan Yunis as a safe area, and then they ask us to evacuate to Rafah. My kids have to go to all of this, they have to be in. By the way, yes, you are right. My kids are coming to me to Cairo, but the three of them, they are sick. I will move them immediately. Once I hold them, I will move them to the hospital because they are very sick. There's no clean water. They don't have healthy food there. It's horrible. I'm happy that my kids are coming to my hug, that I'm going to hold them. But I'm so devastated about the hundreds of the thousands of the kids in Gaza City. They have to go through this, all of these circumstances. And the international community are silent. And a lot of them are supporting it, like as Paul Pillar said, that Biden is a partner in making the biggest human disaster that the world is witnessing since 500 years ago. This is the situation, that the kids and the women have to go through it, that they don't have food to eat, a clean water to drink. My kids have infection in their mouth, in their stomach. They are very thin. My wife had to send me photos for them after I asked her many times, send me a photo for my kids. I was shocked. They are not my kids at all. I just left them for 1 month and they are completely changed. I will do my best to get them recovered and get better health and get better food. But what about the other people in Gaza Strip, the other kids, the women who don't find milk for their kids? My wife couldn't find antibiotic for my kids. Only antibiotic. I mean, this is the most simple medicine that you should have in any place in the world. Even in the jungle, you would find antibiotic and painkiller. I will do my best with my kids for sure, but I'm very devastated, very sad about 2.3 million of Palestinians who are pushed into the south of Gaza Strip. I would say that, yeah, my kids, we made it. They are coming to Cairo, like in 5, 6, 7 hours, whatever. I don't care. They are coming to my hug again. And we all of us are gonna travel to US for 5 months, starting from January until the end of May. I was so lucky to get a fellowship from an American organization, but the majority of the people do not have this chance and do not have this privilege to do the same. This is injustice at all. It's insane at all what is happening there. Cannot be explained, cannot be discussed. I mean, in a normal conversation, we need millions of cameras. I always keep saying that every Palestinian family has its own story, and every member of every Palestinian family has his or her own story, because everyone has a story that is full of tears, full of fear, full of being scared, full of hunger. We are being fighted by making us starving, as the Human Rights Watch have said, I think, yesterday or early today. Yes, Israel is fighting us by food. They are preventing us to get food. The number of the trucks that's of humanitarian aid that should be allowed to enter Gaza is nothing.
Well,
we need much doubles. We need thousands of trucks to enter Gaza 24 hours until 3 months until we get the balance, at least for the food only. We will need at least 10 years to reconstruct and rebuild the destroyed Gaza Strip. That is the real face of the Israeli occupation by and Palestinian people will never forgive the world. The Nakba in 1948, it happened where there is no cameras, there is no TVs, like now. But now, the international community are silent. I do thanks, of course, and appreciate all the demonstration and the march that went to the street in solidarity with the Palestinian people. We think that it's not still enough. We need from you more pressure against the international community, against your leaders, especially the U.S. administration. They have to stop supporting Israel by providing them the military that we are being killed by it. They have to stop financially support Israel, or at least asking Israel, or at least, I mean, preventing of issuing veto in the Security Council when the Palestinian people need only a humanitarian ceasefire.
Fadi Abu Shamala, I want to thank you so much for being with us. In fact, our next segment, we're going to look at that Human Rights Watch report with its author. Yes, the report called Israel's Starvation Used as a Weapon of War in Gaza. Fadi, I want to thank you for being with us. Fadi Abu Shamala, Just Vision's Outreach Associate, usually in Gaza, now in Cairo. Executive Director of Gaza's General Union of Cultural Centers will be reuniting with his three children and wife in just a few hours, then soon coming to the United States. We want to thank civil rights attorney Sophia Akbar and Narman Abu Shaban, Palestinian-American, attempting to expedite her request to rescue her siblings and their families from Gaza. Her mother died there while waiting to get out, as did her uncle. Coming up, Human Rights Watch. Stay with us. Sakamoto, the Japanese musician and activist, passed away this year. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As the death toll in Gaza nears 20,000, Human Rights Watch has accused the Israeli government of using starvation as a weapon of war in Gaza. Human Rights Watch says Israel's deliberately blocked the delivery of water, food, and fuel while willfully impeding humanitarian assistance. The group said Israel's also apparently razed agricultural areas inside Gaza as many Palestinians face starvation. We're joined now by Omar Shakir, Israel and Palestine Director, Human Rights Watch, which has just published a report headlined Israel, Starvation Used as a Weapon of War in Gaza. He's joining us from Amman, Jordan. Omar, why don't you lay out your findings?
We found five very disturbing trends coming together that led us to this conclusion. The first of which has been, for more than 2 months now, the Israeli government has been blocking all but a trickle of aid, food, and water from entering the Gaza Strip. Secondly, the Israeli government has, in essence, cut off the entry and exit of goods from its own crossings with Gaza, despite being the occupying power that's obligated to provide for the civilian population. Third, satellite imagery that we've been carefully studying shows the apparent deliberate raising of agricultural land. You can see entire farms and other areas turned from lush green agricultural land into barren wasteland in different parts of the Gaza Strip. Fourth, we look at the destruction of the kinds of objects necessary for human survival. Bakeries, wheat mills, sanitation and water facilities, hospitals. In northern Gaza, you cannot find many of these facilities that are functioning. And fifth and finally, statements from Israeli government officials that set out in very plain terms, and this includes the defense minister, the national security minister, members of COGAT, the Israeli army, that state quite clearly that they will continue to prevent these basic supplies, food, water, aid, from entering until they accomplish the objectives they've set, such as the return of hostages and the destruction of Hamas. All this collectively amounts to starvation used as a weapon of war, which is an abhorrent war crime, adding to the Israeli government's many other war crimes, like collective punishment that have been taking place over the last 10 weeks.
And Omar, specifically in terms of the deprivation of clean water to drink and fuel, you talk about the impacts of this policy in terms of the spread of disease and access to food.
Absolutely. Look, I mean, I think water is a basic thing that's needed for health services, for everyday life, for cleaning. And you've seen several things take place with water. The first thing is to note that 97% of the groundwater in Gaza is unfit for human consumption as a result of over-extraction of the ground aquifer that comes in from Israel. So Gaza has long relied on water that's coming in from Israel. Israel cut that water supply after October 7th. It's resumed piping to parts of southern Gaza. But in northern Gaza, that's not the case. We've also seen significant destruction of the water infrastructure. We've also seen destruction to other water facilities, pipelines. And you have the lack of fuel that's led to the shutdown of desalinization water pumping facilities. So you have some water coming in on trucks, but bottled water is not enough to allow the population to drink, for hospitals to function, for sanitation to take place. And the results are quite deadly. We're already seeing reports of thousands of cases of contagious diseases, and we're seeing hospitals trying to make do. And of course, the majority of hospitals in Gaza are not functioning. The Israeli government has been systematically attacking hospitals, especially in northern Gaza. But those that are operating are trying to do so without adequate supply of medical supplies and water. And the consequences are stark, and they will get worse unless we see the tap switched on water and the ability for the water infrastructure to be repaired and fuel to enter so those pumping stations and desalinization plants can operate.
What actions do you see necessary by the international community at this point, especially given the fact that the United States continues to veto any resolutions in the Security Council?
I think today's UN Security Council vote is quite essential. There's an opportunity to take concrete action to protect civilians. It's critical that states support that resolution and the United States not exercise its veto. Lives quite literally hang in the balance. Beyond the action at the Security Council, there's absolutely a need for states to unequivocally condemn this war crime. We've seen far too often, especially the United States and its allies in Europe, that are condemning rightfully abuses that are carried out by Palestinian armed groups, but not using the same language to condemn the clear war crimes committed by the Israeli government. There needs to be a call for an immediate resumption of full aid, not the trickle that's being allowed in, but the aid alone is not enough. There needs to be a restoration of electricity, water, and other basic services. And ultimately, that's not going to matter if unlawful attacks and incessant bombardment continue to wreak havoc on the lives of people. There must be an end to an unlawful attacks. And obviously, more long-term, beyond these sort of immediate needs of the civilian population, there are a couple of essential things that are needed. One, there must be accountability for unlawful attacks and other violations, including at the International Criminal Court. Secondly, there must be an addressing of root causes, such as Israel's apartheid against Palestinians. And finally, all states must evaluate all forms of potential complicity in these grave abuses. And in the case of the United States, that means imposing an arms embargo, ending the provision of military assistance and arms, given the high risk they'll be used in the commission of grave abuses.
If you can talk, Omar Shakir, about the Biden administration's, to say the least, mixed message, bypassing Congress, sending tank artillery that is being used against Palestinians, saying that they're staunchly behind Israel, then at the same time saying they're putting out a private message that they've got to reduce the casualties, and at the same time vetoing UN Security Council resolutions, so it's not clear what's going to happen today. They want the language watered down, but may not stop that resolution from going forward. We'll find out soon. Can you talk about what exactly the U.S. is doing versus France calling for a ceasefire versus Germany, Britain, and what it would mean if the U.S. were on the front of calling for a permanent ceasefire?
Look, I think the United States and Israel are isolated in the international community. There is a growing consensus, as reflected in UN votes and otherwise, about the enormity of the catastrophe that we're seeing taking place in Gaza and the urgent need for action to end that. There has indeed been a shift in the U.S. government rhetoric. President Biden spoke of Israel's indiscriminate bombing in Gaza. Indiscriminate bombing is a violation of the laws of war. So if this is the assessment of the Biden administration, how can it justify providing military support? That risks complicity in what they themselves have acknowledged to be war crimes. The reality here is the Israeli government has a long track record of unlawful attacks, U.S. weapons, as has been documented in previous rounds of hostilities by Human Rights Watch, as has been documented by Amnesty International, has itself been used in the commission of grave abuses over the years. The reality here is the United States, by continuing to provide arms and diplomatic cover to the Israeli government as it commits atrocity, risks complicity in these underlying abuses. That not only sends the wrong message, that not only undermines the protection of Israeli and Palestinian civilians, but it undermines the very international human rights and humanitarian law that the United States mobilizes and cites when it comes to places like Ukraine and elsewhere in the world, undermining the protection of civilians, the use of double standards in Israel-Palestine, harm civilians everywhere in the world. The Biden administration has the chance to make the right choice here, to begin to match its some of its recent words with action. And we hope the United States will not veto today's resolution. Doing so will be incredibly damaging to civilians on the ground and to the United States and its position globally.
We just have 30 seconds, but this issue of starvation is not only being raised by Human Rights Watch. World Food Program warned of the immediate possibility of starvation. On December 6th, you have this high risk of famine right through to now. As we wrap up, what this means, we just heard our previous guest talking about what's happened to his children from disease to hunger. Your final comment.
You have a reality where 9 out of 10 households in North Gaza have gone You have a reality where 9 of 10 households, according to the World Food Program in North Gaza, have been without food for a whole day and a whole night. Imagine families that have to spend hours or more a day just to be able to get a couple of pieces of bread to feed their family. We're seeing hundreds of bodies pile up a day in airstrikes. We risk seeing that or more in the days ahead if there isn't urgent action by world leaders to end these atrocities.
Omar Shakir of Human Rights Watch, we thank you so much for being with us. And we wrap by saying happy birthday to Renee Feltz.
Hey, my name's Katie. You want some cool new music to listen to? Want to know about up-and-coming artists, albums, and more? Well, come hang with me every Tuesday from 12 to 1. Raccoon City's where I'll be. Hope to see you there.
The staff and volunteers at CJSF wish you a jolly, merry, happy, joyful, fantastic, exciting, fancy, magnificent, remarkable, special, white, sparkling, terrific, stunning, festive, and wonderful holiday season.